So I was on Kennedy Space Center at the NASA Causeway, which is actually a really fantastic place to view a launch. We were about 3 miles away, and from where I was watching, it looked like the rocket was just going straight up. And it was really an amazing view. It's the closest I've ever been to a rocket launch and the biggest rocket I've ever seen launch. So between that and having an instrument on there, it's really just a hard to describe, really exciting moment.
So when it took off into the sky and continued on a very successful track upwards into the heavens, what was your reaction to that?
It's really just sort of awe at the very beginning, where it's super bright, it's super loud, and then after that, there's another 40 minutes of sort of nail-biting for those of us that are following it closely, because that's when you've got the main engine cut off, you've got the second stage starting, you've got the third stage starting, and then eventually you finally get the spacecraft separating and the solar panels deployed. It's not till then that you really have a spacecraft that's in space operating on its own with power coming from the sun, and you know that you're actually safe in the environment. And I have to say the most nerve-wracking moment has not even come yet, because our instrument doesn't turn on until launch plus about 20 days or so. And at that point, we finally get to see whether the instrument is still functioning, whether anything broke during launch, and whether it operates the way we expect it to in space. And so that's really the moment of truth for our instrument team.
And I suppose if it doesn't activate or there's some type of malfunction, there's really not much you can do about it at that stage.
Well, yeah, we're on the way to the sun right now, so there's nobody going to be going to visit it and fix it up. But you'd be surprised at what engineers can do with something that's in space. So we have a lot of software that we can change, and we can run in different modes. And so if something's not quite behaving the way we expect, then a lot of times we figure out a way around it, and we still manage to get really good data out of the instrument.
Kind of the high-tech equivalent of wiggling the rabbit ears on an old TV?
It is exactly that, yes.
So speaking about the instrument, Tony, I know that there is a lot of people working on this, a vast team effort, including your agency. What was your contribution to this mission?
So the instrument that we built is called the Solar Probe Cup. So it's an instrument that measures the particles flowing from the sun that we call the solar wind. And our instrument, it was built at a number of institutions, including where I'm at, the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, and also the University of California, Berkeley. It peaks around the heat shield, so most of the instruments are hiding back in the shadow, but our instrument pokes around the heat shield, looks directly at the sun, and measures the particles that are coming from the sun. So it's sort of like, it really is just a cup sticking out into a solar wind, and particles just kind of flow into it, and we catch them and count how many of them there are. So, yeah, about Labor Day, our instrument will get turned on, we'll ramp up our high voltage. That's one of the riskiest things we do, because we have to go up to 4,000 volts. And so that just naturally leads to sort of an inherent danger in arcing and sparking, we say, where high voltage doesn't do what you want it to. So that's sort of the moment of truth for us. And then throughout that 45 days, we get everything cranked up and ready to go. And then we finally start our first close approach to the sun, where we actually start taking measurements.
And for the Parker Solar Probe, how long does that next phase last?
So the entire mission is 7 years. We have an orbit about once every 3 to 4 months, depending on what phase of the mission we're in. So we're continuously orbiting the sun, swooping in and going as close as 10 solar radii from the sun, which is well inside the orbit of Mercury. And then we continue our orbit around and we end up at the farthest point from the sun, which is out past Venus. So we're continuously going in and out and in and out in this orbit. And each one takes 3 to 4 months. And within that orbit, we have the prime science data collection period, which is about 10 or 11 days around that closest approach. So that takes place around the end of October for the first time, and then 24 more times over the ensuing 7 years after that.
At the end of its seven-year mission, does the Parker Solar Probe simply go offline, or is it expected to come back somehow, or what's the next phase, the final phase, I guess, for the probe?
There are a lot of things that can limit the lifetime of a mission. Some of those things are like radiation damage or using up your propellant, or sometimes just lack of funding. And so we hope that the thing that really slows us down is the propellant issue, but that's not for a number of years after our prime mission, which is 7 years. So we will operate for the next 7 years And if we're getting good data results, then we will apply for an extended mission, they call it, where we get more funding and continue operating the spacecraft. And then eventually we will run out of fuel. And when we run out of fuel, the spacecraft will no longer be able to orient itself in the right direction. So though it will continue orbiting the sun in the same orbit that it has been in, it will no longer be able to keep the heat shield pointed directly at the sun, which is a key design of the spacecraft. And so when that happens, things that are not meant to be hot start getting hot, and then bad things happen. Now, we don't really analyze that situation, but you can imagine that all of the plastics that might be used or any of the other materials that are not meant to be hot start melting, start vaporizing, all of those things, and eventually the spacecraft sort of burns up. Now, the interesting thing about our instrument is that it's made of these really high-temperature materials because it is exposed directly to the sun. And so I expect that our instrument will actually continue to exist in very much its current form and just orbit the sun as a big hunk of metal. So that's sort of an interesting thing to think about. I think our instrument will really live on beyond the mission, certainly, and beyond our lifetimes, and possibly even until the end of the solar system.
Last piece standing. I like that.
Yep.
So, Tony, I originally talked to you just before the 20th anniversary of the Thurston High School shooting. And at that time, you didn't know how you might observe the event. I'm just curious to follow up on that. And when the anniversary did come around, what did you do?
Sort of the same way we marked every other anniversary. So I was in email contact with my parents and my doctors that I'm still in contact with. And so we passed some emails back and forth saying, you know, how we were thankful for everybody, all the work that the doctors had done. And so that was all just, you know, it's the same thing we do every year. But it's always nice to just reconnect with everybody and be able to, you know, tell them how much you appreciate them. So it's just a sort of small moment of Thanksgiving and that's nice. Also, my girlfriend got me a 20-year-old bottle of cognac. So that was nice.
But beyond that, you've said before, you don't give the incident a whole lot of thought.
No, I don't. There are a lot of days that go by that I don't think about it. So it certainly doesn't affect me. And I'm fortunate that I have so many good things in my life, like my job, for example, and being down here and watching a rocket launch with something that I've worked so hard on. You know, I have enough good things in my life that I don't need to dwell on the bad ones. So I'm thankful for that.
Anything else you'd like to share, Tony? Anything you'd like to say to the folks listening back in the Springfield, Eugene area?
Well, I just appreciate my upbringing in Springfield so much. You know, I think I had such a great childhood, great friends and family around there, great school system to go through that really allowed me to be successful and be down here working on projects as exciting as this. And so it's a place that it feels like home, and I will always enjoy going back there and seeing everyone, and wish that there was more of a space industry there so I could actually move back to Oregon and still be able to work on the cool stuff that I'm currently working on. I think this is one of the most exciting missions to come around in the last decade. And it's, as far as heliophysics, it's really a once in a generation sort of mission to be working on. And I'm really thankful for that. I think that there is going to be data taken during this mission that's going to be looked at and analyzed by scientists for decades to come, for sure. And it's really going to change the picture of how we know that the sun works. It's probably going to raise as many questions as answers it's going to give us. And it's going to provide us a lot of new thought for designing the next big mission to sort of give us an insight into the basic fundamental physics processes that are really driving this star that's at the center of our solar system.
Tony Case, astrophysicist, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.